interviewed by Renee Garalick for Concord's Oral History Program. The interview is taking place at his home at 27 River Street on January 7, 1980. Mr. Edmonds is 76 years old. While you have resided in Concord for almost a quarter of a century, it was the Erie Canal area and the Black River Valley that were the inspiration for your early novels.
Well, yes, Mrs. Garalick, I was born in a little town called Boonville, about 4 miles from the Black River, which runs from the southern Adirondacks to Lake Ontario northwards. And my father had a big farm, ran a big farm there. He was a New York lawyer, and what they used to call a gentleman farmer. And I was born one summer in the house in Boonville. And for many years, actually, I slept in the room in which I was born for my later years, because my parents occupied it earlier. So to me, the farm and the Black River Valley and the neighboring stories of the old canal boaters who were retired mostly by the time I'd begun to grow up a little. I became fascinated in the countryside and the people and the and ultimately in the building and operation of the Erie Canal. So when I decided 2 years after college that I wanted to be a writer, this would have been in 28, I began writing stories and presently a novel, Rome Hall, about the upstate region and the canal. And it really goes back earlier than that, though, because when I was in a day school in New York, my first stories are not professional ones. They're written for an English class and had a great deal to do with it. Animals of the woods and the farms and things. And the teacher used to read them aloud in class regularly. In fact, I and Conan Doyle seemed to alternate, because he also read us Conan Doyle stories, Sherlock Holmes stories. And so perhaps my real beginning as a writer was in these stories about animals and happenings in nature on our farm.
How did you come to write your first novel?
Well, the year after I graduated from college, I spent on the farm in Boonville, and I wrote, I think, 6 or 7 short stories that winter, of which I sold 3 or possibly 4. And in those days, a story in the Atlantic Monthly magazine, or the Dial, to which I sold another, or Harper's, or Scribner's, would bring perhaps 100 and 125, and I actually got 150 for one, which I thought was fine, but suddenly I realized that I wasn't going to pay my way in life writing short stories for the so-called quality magazines. So I wrote Mr. Sedgwick, to whom I had sold 2 stories, of the Atlantic Monthly, the editor of the Atlantic Monthly, and asked him if he would have a job in his editorial offices for a reader, which was about all I thought I was competent to do. And he wrote back at once and saying, why didn't I come down and see him, because he wanted to talk to me about a possible project. And I came down, this was in the autumn, and went out to see him in his place in Beverly, and he took me into his study, and he said, have you ever considered writing a novel about the Erie Canal? Well, all through my last 2 years in college, and through that winter after college, I thought a great deal about a book, a story about a young man who goes to work on the canal and ultimately acquires a canal boat, and his love affair with a girl brought up on the canal. And essentially, being a farmer, I knew that he was going to leave the canal and she wasn't. So I told Mr. Sedgwick the story as I conceived it, and he said, if I would come down to Cambridge or Boston and hole up in a little room somewhere and write the story and deliver it to him by the end of March, he would publish it. An extremely rash statement. And as he afterwards confessed, he was really rather terrified at what I might put into his hands. Well, fortunately, I not only finished the book by the end of March, but by the end of February. And I had never written anything so fast before or since. And still more fortunately, Mr. Sedgwick liked the book and wrote me so with considerable astonishment in a letter which I still have, and guaranteed that it would be published indeed, and so it came out the following year, which was 1929. And it was quite a little success. And the press and Little Brown, who did the Atlantic Press books, did the business and promotion and sales of them, really pushed the book quite hard. And though it made quite a bit of money, it wasn't what you call money today in the writing game. I think it made me probably all of $15,000 or $20,000 over the years too. But at that time, $20,000 looked like an enormous sum. And I decided, having met a young woman whom I was very much taken with, that I could perfectly well support her with my writing. And got married, and then really the screws began to be turned on me as children came and bills came. And I, though I wrote another novel, The Big Barn, which came out the following year, it was not successful. And a third novel I have never shown anybody. And my fourth novel, Erie Water, which came out in 1933, was successful, but only mildly. And it became very important to me to turn to writing short stories, not so much for the quality magazines, but for the so-called slick magazines, like the Saturday Evening Post and the Ladies' Home Journal and Country Gentleman, which paid a great deal more money.
Your novel, Drums Along the Mohawk, to many people has become a classic.
Well, I suppose it has. I'm constantly meeting school children, either in school or more likely some who graduated some years ago, who said they had read Drums Along the Mohawk, some rather aggressively. And of course, it was recommended by teachers in schools, even in the schools of Pontiac, Michigan, where, along with Carol Buck, it was Her Good Earth, it was banned as pornographic. But that has never troubled me. The book, for some reason, which is about the settlers, the early settlers in the Mohawk Valley during the Revolution and their struggles to protect their farms against the British Tories and the colonial Tories mostly, and the Mohawk Indians. For some reason it appealed to people at that time. It was in the Depression, and America, the United States, was in a very confused state of mind. And here was a simple story, a chronicle, in fact, about what had happened up there and how people had managed to look after themselves, which I think is the reason that it became so popular. And it is a real chronicle in that it deals with many local figures. One or two national figures like Benedict Arnold appear, but they're not character studies in any way. They're just there, and they did what they did, and they left, thank the Lord, as far as he was concerned. So I suppose because so many people have been made to read it when they were young, their excuse is that it is a classic.
You have this mixture between the fictional and the historic characters.
Oh, yes. That's because of my stories are the product of my childhood. so that I base a great many of them on incidents that I've observed and on real people. And though I try not to use actual people in my stories, there is a close similarity between in my protagonist, between the real and the fictional persons. This may be, as Edmund Wilson used to tell me, return to the fantasies of childhood. But that apparently is how I made, and I'm still writing that way, though with much less popular success, I might add.
Your style of telling a story is that the author should remain rather invisible.
When I took Professor Charles Townsend Copeland's course at Harvard, which I might add, I entered practically wielding blackmail over the old boy's head, because my first submitted story he sold to Scribner's magazine, which really was why I thought maybe I could become a professional writer. But Copy was a teacher of composition, which doesn't mean that he taught people to write novels or stories. He didn't believe that anyone could teach anybody to write a story or a novel, and I have always thought he was right about that. What he taught was tried to teach, and did, I think, was the how to use the English language. And from the beginning, he used to tell me that the ideal was to have the author style so clear that the author himself was invisible, and there was only the subject and the reader. And to that end, he used to make me read a lot of Dean Swift's books and papers, and George Borrow and Defoe. They all used very simple, direct English. And of course, there is nobody better than Shakespeare, though he can produce a kind of thunder and glory that neither of the other writers could.
Do you find this is at variance with what critics like to see? Do they like a more individualistic style?
Critics like something to get a handle hold of, I think. At least they've always said that my style was a flat, cold, dead style. And I think they used commas to bring out what they meant. But that's their privilege, and I just write as this seems best to me.
You tend to be interested in simple people.
Well, I suppose that was because of my upbringing. My best friend was the son of a farmer down the river. And as I took over the old farm, which I no longer farm, but kept as a place and tried to foster the wildlife on it, he came to look after the place for me, and no better friend could any man have had. But he was there until I had to sell the place 3 or 4 years ago. We'd been there for over 30 years, and we'd never had an argument or angry word between us. And so I think I came to know him very well, and I also came to know the people who worked in the neighborhood, and to me, the land around upper New York County, upper Oneida County, is filled with a wonderful mixture of people, some simple, some rather really complicated. Of course, if you take Edmund Wilson, who was a summer resident, very complicated indeed.
Some of your novels were made into screenplays and movies?
Oh yes, three were. The first one, Rome Falls, was made into a play by Mark Connolly and a man named Frank Elsa, who had made the original play, which was fairly successful in that colleges liked to use it, but not adapted for a Broadway production. And he asked Mark Connolly to come in and collaborate with him on his play. and Mark practically rewrote the play, and it came out as The Farmer Takes a Wife, with Henry Fonda as the star, his first starring vehicle. And then it was made into a movie. And guess who was the hero? Henry Fonda was the hero. But now he had, instead of June Walker, as his Molly Larkins, he had Janet Gaynor. And I think that was one of her early major roles in the movies, I'm not sure. Then Drums Along the Mohawk practically had to be made into a movie, I suppose, because it was so successful, and also because of Daryl Zanuck's passion for historical subjects and turning them into movies. And Drums Along the Mohawk is fairly good history, even if it's only local history. So that came out, and it had a hero, and to everybody's astonishment, it was Henry Fonda again. And the third, I didn't very much like the movie, except for Edna May Oliver as the Irish widow who befriends Henry Fonda, and who to me has always been the most marvelous character actress. Well, then the third book was Chad Hanna, a book about early circuses in about the 30s in the United States, well, actually crossing upstate New York. Where else would they have been in one of my books? And again, the young man who sort of comes into the circus and finally takes it over, more or less, or the management of it, was guess who? Henry Fonda. So I don't know what I could have done without Henry Fonda, but I'm sure he did all right without me, as we come to look at his career in future years, now long past.
Some of your recent books have come out as children's books.
Yes, shortly after I wrote Drums Along the Mohawk, that was in 1936 it came out, Dodd Mead and Company, a New York publisher, came to me and suggested that a book I had written and had been published in the Saturday Evening Post called The Spanish Gun would make a good story for children. So I was sorry, but my publishers and I didn't want to have any of my work come out except under their aegis. And so I went to the Atlantic Monthly Press, and they consulted Little Brown, and they were not interested. But I just the same declined Dodd Mead's offer. But the next year they came back again, and I again went to the Atlantic Press, and at my agent, when they turned it down at my agent's urging, I said, well, Dodd Mead could do it. So it came out as The Matchlock Gun, and was very fortunate in winning the Newbery Medal. And then they turned to my old Saturday Evening Post stories that had come out over the years and began publishing children's books from them. Actually, they are very little changed. Bob Mead was very very puritanical in its approach to liquor in children's books, and they didn't want an old senator to take a drink. Well, I refused to let him go without his whiskey, and it was not a regular whiskey, it was only a couple of glasses, and it came out, and luckily no librarian or teacher seems to have been very offended. They took this as one of the odd habits that senators have to indulge in to continue as senators. And then, after a while, through circumstances which I have no intention of detailing, except that I thought I had been treated with enormous shabbiness by Dodd Mead, I began taking my children's books to Little Brown. But having run out of old stories, my backlog of stories, I decided one summer to write a story about the little creatures who come into a so-called summer house, country house, when the human occupants go back to the city for the winter. And I wrote it, and really more or less for my three little granddaughters who were on the place at the time, and used to read the chapters aloud in the evenings. They were so impressed that they would get completely dressed up in their best city dresses and come over and listen to Grandpa's latest chapter, all sitting on the floor around my feet, which was very good for an old man's ego, because most of them were very pretty indeed. And I brought this out as a book called Time to Go House, which is a moderate success. But it's interesting to me in that it is the first book I ever wrote deliberately for children. And it's also interesting that it has been not so successful as many that came out as children, as adult stories, and were published as such. Which leads me to think that writing for children, you are apt to write down a bit to children, and that what's important is not a children's story, but just a story. If it's a good story, as I said to Little Brown, who brought Time to Go House out, and asked me what age group it was for, I wrote it for people from 8 to 80. And I think that's the way all stories should be written.
Would you say that is true of Bert Green's Barn?
Yes, I didn't write Bert Green's Barn deliberately for children. I wrote it as an incident that had happened on our place. I made it from an incident that had happened on our place. I wrote the story really for myself. It's not meant particularly for children.
Bert Green's Barn received the National Book Award, didn't it? And it came out just in 1975, very recently.
Yes, it did. And I think that the reason it received favor was that it was a return to an old-fashioned kind of writing and situation about the story is about a poor boy whose father has abandoned the family and who tries to lift his family out of poverty. And one of the ways of doing it that he imagined would be effective was to get possession of an old abandoned barn with a very good framework and move it down to the little scratch farm he and his mother and two sisters worked together. And the story is the story of his struggle to move the barn, and incidentally the fact that he found buried under the planks of the floor of the barn a considerable sum of money. Well, that of course is gravy, and I suppose it's gravy for the children, but the story is really a study in customs, and like barn raisings and the running of a feed mill and other things that the boy gets involved in at the turn of the century, when I was just a tiny little boy. And though my recollections, of course, are based about 6 years on in by date, it is a fairly good presentation of country life as it was led in this country at the turn of the century.
So Concord certainly has claim to you in writing that book. When you first moved here, you lived right across the street?
No, I first moved here, my wife and I, the second marriage for both of us, and we had children at home where we lived for a while on the Shortick Hill. But when they moved on, got married and so forth, as people happen to do, so we looked around for a smaller house, and also, as we were getting older, one nearer the center of town. So we found this one on River Street, where we've been very happy together.
If you had to single out the one biggest change in lifestyle from a quarter of a century ago, what would you say?
Oh, my wife and I were talking about it with a friend only a few days ago. And when we first lived on a Shortick Hill, we never locked the door. We even would go in for the Friday Symphony and leave the front door and the kitchen door unlocked. It never occurred to us that anybody would break into the house. They wouldn't have had to break in, just walk into the house. Or if they walked in, that they would walk out without lifting the silver or a picture or rugs or whatever it is they walk out with nowadays. And from that we have gone to We're locking our doors. We never leave our car outside in the driveway without locking it. We even have gone to the terrifying, to me, device of having a burglar alarm. I'm so afraid to find myself with the alarm whistling and yelling around me and the police coming in the door and saying, "Get Edmonds."
You have some rather illustrious ancestors in the town.
Oh yes, on my father's side, we are directly descended from Peter Bulkley, who was one of the founding fathers of Concord, I believe. And also my cousin and my wife's cousin, she and I are cousins. My mother's cousin and my mother's wife's cousin was Louisa May Alcott. So we do have, between us, we have really quite a claim to being proper citizens of Concord.
You chose an appropriate second home then. Thank you.